We have had the good fortune to been granted permission by the publishing company Chelsea Green Publishers and by the editor of the writings of David Fleming, who Sean Chamberlain created a book out of David Fleming's sort of masterwork called Lean Logic. Big book. Someone just gave me a copy of it.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, yeah. It's quite a book.
One of the Kingston Transition people gave me a copy of it. And so we have been fortunate enough for them to grant us the permission to air chapters of the audiobook, which is recently out.
Yes, yes. And speaking of a blue wave, what's the name of this week's chapter?
This week's chapter is called Eroticism.
Well, there you have it.
And you know, without further ado, let's just get to Sean Chamberlain and his wonderful reading of this book and this chapter.
Chapter 6, Eroticism. Our present society fills much of its empty space with thoughts of sex, yet it is not comfortable with the erotic. Far from integrating it into its culture, it buries it deep in the private sphere, a personal matter like remembering to take your medication. At the end of the road we are travelling on, desire will be not a hunger to be celebrated, but an issue to be sorted. Owing to anxieties about its abuse, society is even losing the language of touch. Touch has a large vocabulary of meaning, between bliss and pain, none of which can be abandoned without loss. Tactile deprivation leaves a misery of depression, cold isolation and emotional withdrawal, followed by trouble, when touch is the central skill needed for complex endeavours, such as marriage and child-raising. At the same time, we are losing the touch of language, for language began as a replacement for grooming, and, with careful, gentle articulation, it too has mildly erotic qualities. It works best when you take your time, travelling hopefully rather than being distracted by arrival. Lean communities will be held together by both touch and sound. Soporific. Inspissated. Stretch. Smooth. Evocative. Dappled, spinster, Limpopo, slow and attentive is best. The erotic is an energy source. Its energy is desire, intense, beyond your own control and intention, and unsafe, like a cliff path without a handrail. You lack detachment, you are there, right at the edge. This is not your territory, you are on the lip of someone else's. Surviving the future argues that this energy feeds into, gives intensity to, all our other emotions. The erotic is the dazzling power supply, the solar energy, on which we depend for the whole of our emotional lives. At its heart is the possibility of a gift. Things that you take are more or less under your control, and to that extent lack excitement. Things that you are given have an independent life of their own. You can never be quite sure that they will come your way, nor that, if they do, they will be the real thing, nor that what you give back is as real as what you receive. But you live in hope on all these, aware that this garden will yield its reciprocal gifts, only if it is cultivated and watered and walked in. Mane sugamus ad vinias, videamus si floriat vinia, si flores fructus patruriant, si fluriant mala punica, ibi dabo tibi ubera mia. Let us rise up early and go to the vineyards. Let us see if the vine flourish, whether the tender grape appear and the pomegranate are ripening. There will I give thee my breasts. This sense of giving and surrender irrigates every other aspect of our culture. The extent to which we enter into a Corot landscape or a Vermeer household is the extent to which we surrender ourselves to them. The English poet George Herbert was intent on surrender, seeming not to mind too much whether it was to a woman or to God. He needed the erotic. He knew the ways of pleasure, the sweet strains, the lullings and the relishes of it, the propositions of hot blood and brains, what mirth and music mean. And here is Richard Crashaw being rather carried away, it seems. Lord, when the sense of thy sweet grace sends up my soul to seek thy face, thy blessed eyes breed such desire, I die in love's delicious fire. We have this idea too in the mystic tradition of Islam, Sufism, intoxicated with love, living with ecstasy, for which the soul needs the wings of human love to fly towards divine love. It is the ladder leading to the love of the merciful. And this is also the unlikely location of medieval monasticism, empowering with erotic energy a multinational institution designed for spiritual observance, care of those in need, education, publishing, archiving, and population control. Although the monks and nuns of that long-lived tradition did, in some ways, leave the world upon a shelf, as Chaucer observed in the Canterbury Tales, the principle was, do not repress energetic drives such as sex. Use them as the energy source for talent, love, and hard thinking, but set them in a different context. There was, it is true, an evident risk of failure and compromise in redirecting these drives from the erotic love of people to loving God. But the monastic discipline was skillful and experienced. It knew how to handle large resources of emotional energy and how to contain it within the context of music and poetry, the graphic arts and prayer, architecture, charity, philosophy, community building, and that daily workout for the emotions provided by the Psalms. The result could not be described as repressed. The aim, wrote the 12th century scholar Hugh of St. Victor, was to see what the untutored eye does not see and to form desire. By subjecting oneself to authority and learning how to recognize virtue. In short, learning to master a skill, to love your subject and get emotional about it. Tears of desire for heaven were positively encouraged. Emotional energy was recognized as a reserve, waiting to be tapped. It was an emotional training which lasted into the 17th century, and one way of keeping in trim was to do the program of spiritual exercises which had been devised by St. Ignatius of Loyola. 4 weeks of contemplation of the life, passion, and resurrection of Christ could wake the soul from its torpor and make the south wind blow over the garden of the soul, bringing the tears of intense affection. The Judaic Christian is, perhaps this is its most astonishing quality, a culture of emotional depth. This is not mysticism, it is not ascetic, it is no exercise in willpower and self-control. On the contrary, it celebrates the passions. The passion is a story of wringing emotion, pain, grief, love, derision, resolution. It consists almost entirely of emotional events and expression, as Bach demonstrated when he set it to music. The narrative or poetic truth therein is about a raising from the dead. But there is some direct material truth in there too, for love, being the source of emotional life, can claim, rather more literally, to do the same thing. Richard Crashaw summarizes this in a 3-line request, confident of his answer. Oh, let that love which thus makes thee mix with our low mortality, lift our lean souls. Lauda Sion Salvatorem, 1652. A culture which contains such emotional energy makes it available for the relationships between the people who live there, for the common purpose of making and sustaining community. And it celebrates this private good in the public sphere. All animal behavior is driven by the emotions, so it is a good idea to keep them fit and well, observant and in training for their life on the edge between us and everything else. The erotic is but one emotion among many, but maybe it is the deepest and most ancient one. And, for surviving the future, it is the critical energy source for all others. Emotions know the ways of pleasure, the lullings and the relishes of it, the proposition of hot blood and brains, what mirth and music mean. Erotic energy is their blood supply.
That's chapter 6 from Surviving the Future, Culture, Carnival, and Capital in the Aftermath of the Market Economy. A short but powerful chapter.
It sure is. It's interesting how short it is because it's so critical and it's also so forgotten in our culture. I can go on such a rant here and I have to remember people are listening. But because when he talks about energy source, when he talks about that it is an energy source for all other things, we've completely forgotten that. We have such an issue with eroticism, with sensuality, and ultimately with sex in our culture. And it has become, I think there's a recognition of how powerful it is. So it has become objectified and abstracted and controlled in so many ways that we can't tap into what's underneath it, which is, it's so powerful and it runs so deep. And you know, this idea of taken versus given is like, that's it. You know, we've obviously seen through this year with the Me Too movement, the feeling that so much has been taken for so long by men with regard to women. And there is, and I believe this has been going on for thousands of years, really. I mean, I think about the Immaculate Conception, Jesus never having a lover from what we have been told. And so there's this whole framework of taking sex out of the picture. And yet, when everyone turns 13, 14, 15, 16, there are these chemicals running through our body that we're told to suppress, forget about, you know, put on the shelf, do whatever. But I guarantee you, even a couple hundred years ago, we were in not all of us, because it depends on the culture, but we're in these, you know, small tribes, small families. The 14 and 15 year olds were running around having sex. Their parents were taking care of the kids while they were busy. I mean, it was a much different relationship between what our bodies were telling us and kind of getting us to get started on compared to now. And you know, people can't imagine that now, that kind of behavior. And yet, 120 short years ago, the age of consent in every state was 10. So clearly, there is this sort of odd disconnect between, you know, power and control and what, you know, our natural state suggests to us.
Yeah. And I didn't count, maybe I'll go back and count how many times Sean Chamberlain and David Fleming referenced energy.
Right.
In that short paragraph.
That's the key.
Yeah, because it is the energy that drives. It can be perverted. It can be turned into an attempt at power, control. I mean, what's more frightening to many men than a powerfully sexually powerful woman?
Right.
We're gonna control this. We're gonna do it. You know, we're gonna put this in its place. It's Puritanism that has then kicked in on top of that. But underneath, under the underlying energy for this,
for everything.
Yeah.
And it really is. I'll also reference something else, which is Andreas Weber's book Matter and Desire, which talks about everything's in relationship. Everything's erotic. And he's going from the you know, molecular level all the way to the universe, in the sense that we are nothing without being in relationship too. And so we're constantly touching, essentially. And if we don't recognize that that's where the energy source is, And that it's not a means to an end. That's the other part of this, is that we've now created a culture where specifically men are sort of conditioned to take something so they can get something, versus recognizing that the energy is in the process of it. It's not in some final act or you know, outcome. It's actually in the energy of being in that relationship and the power of it and what's generated from it. And it's extremely, well, powerful. I mean, it's and necessary and present always. And we've really forgotten that. We've objectified it to an extraordinary degree.
We've gotten so busy in our own personal lives that, you know, you schedule some, so, you know, you schedule date night or something.
Right.
Because you're trying to find the erotic in your relationship again.
Yeah.
When the erotic can be that touch at that moment. It doesn't, right?
Right.
Doesn't
right.
have to be the you know.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we have lots of visitors and people coming to our house and stuff. And what I'm really noticing with so many people is that, like you said, they get so busy. They have children to raise. They have things to do. They have all these things on their mind, in their head. They forget their physical nature. And one thing I notice over and over again is my wife, Jennifer, and I are constantly touching each other. And I only notice it in reference to most other people. And it's that just, you know, someone's, you know, making dinner and you go over and you just hold them or you touch them or the presence of them creates an energy that you can't get any other way. And yet we are so distracted and in our heads that we forget the power of simply touch.
And that's referenced in the beginning of the chapter, is that when you lose that tactile ability there, you lose it in a lot of places.
Right.
Yeah. And
yeah.
A child who doesn't receive physical affection growing
God.
Up,
yeah.
Right, we know the damage that happens. And many times relationships know they're in deep trouble when the touching right. stops.
Absolutely.
Right?
And again, we see that in our friendships where you can really kind of identify, okay, there's an issue there because they're not just naturally going towards each other. And again, get back down to the atomic level things. There are attractors. There's things that need to be next to each other to create the world we're a part of. And I think as we start to see the Me Too experience and other things, that's just a clear manifestation of something that's gone on for hundreds of years, if not longer, but certainly in this culture, hundreds of years, where it has tried to separate that out. So again, you know, it's so easy to control people when they're already kind of feeling isolated and disconnected.
I'm keenly aware that it's two guys on the
right.
air talking about this.
Good point.
but also aware that there's a lot of feminine energy in your life.
Yes,
Peter.
Absolutely, in so many different ways. And quite frankly, it started with me. I had a wonderful mother that nurtured my completeness. You know, I didn't have somebody saying, you know, don't do this like a girl or stop crying or straighten up or whatever. It was, you know, there was an allowance for me to be fully human. And so therefore, as I become an adult, other women recognize, oh, you're not this hyper-masculine or somehow super gendered person that's going to put me in one place so you can be in another. And in fact, it's much more fluid and open and connected. And so I have I'm sort of humbled by it, frankly, to attract certain women like somebody like Eve Ensler, for instance, but many others who look at me and go, oh, finally, I met some guy that is here in the present without an agenda and isn't looking me up and down or anything else. And that isn't to say, though, that there shouldn't be this sense of you know, a male being in the presence of divine feminine energy in whatever form that takes, and appreciate it and recognize it. And say, wow, you are beautiful. My cellist, Michael Cott, will constantly say to men and women, but mostly women because they might be adorned more specifically in a particular dress or a bracelet or something. And he will just naturally say, you look beautiful. That's a beautiful dress. And now for the first time, he's getting pushback on what is his just natural instinct to appreciate mostly feminine nature.
Yeah, it's and it's an interesting time as we work our way through what is really the beginnings of the Me Too movement. I know it's been around for a year, and I know that you've had conversations with Eve Ensler about what, you know, where this goes in terms of essentially the erotic, right?
Right.
And I know that the power dynamics of someone like Harvey Weinstein, it doesn't have anything to do with the erotic.
Right.
Right.
No, exactly. Yeah. And to really, because I think you're right, we're at the beginning of this because it needed to happen. I mean, these guys needed to be called out, and some women, but, you know, again, mostly men in power positions that use their power to take. Again, it's taking something versus being present with something and then allowing the exchange to happen on its own terms, whatever that might mean. And you know, as Gloria Steinem said, the truth will set you free, but first it'll piss you off. And we're in the piss you off stage for sure, and very understandably.
There are a lot of things in modern society that have been sort of subjugated in a sense, right, that lead to a lot of different things. Stress buildup in life because you're working at a job just because you need to have a job, because it sort of gives you some sense of purpose, but you hate it and it drives you to need pharmaceuticals or whatever, or prescribed or not prescribed, or you're medicating some way, or you're lost in social media, or you're lost in sports or whatever, you know. And the erotic is also in that loop. And it seems like when you start to add some slack into all those things, that there the opportunity for the erotic in the daily life and the daily experience has an opportunity to come back in a healthy way.
Absolutely. I mean, we have so many distractions and so many ways that take us out of presence, really, all those things. And without that slack, I mean, we've been spending the last few days with my nephew and his wife and their three-year-old, and it's been extraordinary to just sit in a room all day with a few different adults. And the three-year-old, because we're not on screens, we're not distracted, the room to experience and for him to experience. And then it always comes down at some point to holding and touching and tactile things. And you know, where that turns into what we would call the erotic, but that lives in lots of ways. Even that, to take it into sexual, isn't correct. You know, it's in this other realm of desire and energy and curiosity and exploration and all these things that just open up possibilities for anything to happen. And again, to not suddenly attach an outcome to it, but just to say, oh, we're in this and we're exploring and we're having fun and isn't this great? And everybody is energized and you can stay up late and you can get up early and life is different.
Indeed. And as we examine the screen usage in my house with nearly 10-year-old, and, you know, and part of the reason why that is and his usage is the way it is because he's got a mother and he's got a father who are fully engaged in what they do in a full-time way.
Yep.
And we need to be more engaged in that, because when we're able to do what you said, take away that screen time and just be the unit, it's a vastly and more wonderful experience.
It's unbelievable. And that is, the screens are incredibly dangerous on so many levels when it comes to this subject, because it takes you away from the present moment. It allows, of course, in the other way of what's on the screen, when kids hit 12, 13, the level of porn, the level of objectification, the level of, again, this whole other world that has nothing to do with even sex for that matter, but certainly the erotic and anything divine. That is where I am seriously worried about where we're headed, because men specifically and actually boys specifically at the age of 13, 14, 15 are experiencing things on a level of objectification and example that go nowhere towards everything this chapter is about.
Indeed. When I was 13, I was walking in heavily wooded areas with no civilization anywhere nearby, hoping to bump into a
wood nymph or something.
You know, a naked widow intemptress instructress, you know.
Right, exactly.
But it was in my head. It was
It was
imagination. It was illusion.
Right.
It was fantasy.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. I love that. I love that, especially because you're in nature. That's where that stuff happens. And
right.
We just don't allow for it anymore.
Kind of bump into someone out there and no one around for miles. The book, again, is called Surviving the Future, Culture Carnival and Capital in the Aftermath of the Market Economy. Peter Buffett, thanks for stopping in this Tuesday afternoon. We'll see you next Tuesday for Chapter 7.
Excellent.
All of the previous chapters that that we've aired and have discussed are available on the archive page. Just search Surviving, and it'll take you to those as well. If you want to get a hard copy of this book, you can do it at Rough Draft in Uptown Kingston. If you go in there, congratulate co-owner Anthony for having run the New York City Marathon on Sunday.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
I will do that.
And then you can click on the Chelsea Green link on our social media if you want to get the audiobook. We highly encourage both the hard copy and the audiobook. I read along with the chapter
yes,
every week here in the studio.